This is Katie Chaka Parks interviewing Jan Stevenson on November 1st, 2018. This interview is taking place at the Purdy Kresge Library at Wayne State University. So, to begin, would you like to tell me when and where you were born?
When and where?
Yes.
I was born in a freight elevator in the hospital of Cleveland University Hospitals in 1955. My mother and father, my father was a musician.
Okay.
He was a big band jazz piano player. He was the most hyper person in the entire planet. And when he heard that my mother went into labor, he did what he would normally do. He panicked. And they rushed to the hospital, and by the time they got there, my mother's water had broken. He was in complete panic, and he saw the delivery sign, and of course, the deliveries go there. And of course, that's where the loading dock was. So they were able to get my mother out of the car and onto a gurney and into the elevator where I was born. My father fainted, and the three of us were carried off the elevator together.
Oh my gosh, that's such a wonderful story of coming into the world.
Yeah, going up.
There you go. Now, how long did you live in Ohio for then?
Until I was like 18. I grew up in a small town in Ohio. Called Bedford. It's a suburb of Cleveland.
Okay. And is that considered, or when you were living there at the time, was that a very LGBTQ-friendly kind of community, or was that not talked about as much? Or
Martians were more familiar than LGBTQ people.
Yes.
No. There was no... I mean, I was born in 1955, so I was there until, you know, the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no LGBT people in Ohio. I was the only one. And when I was about 16, I saw on the news that there were some lesbians in New York that had gotten arrested. And that was the first time I realized that I wasn't the only one. There were a few more. They were in jail, but there were other people in the world. And that was my first inkling that I wasn't the only one, because I thought I was. I figured I was the only person in the world that felt this way. I kept expecting to grow out of it. Mm-hmm. I was completely startled when I realized that I was gay. Mm-hmm. And appalled that it was, I was like, this isn't.
So was that something that was talked about in your family then at the time,
no.
Or not then either?
No, it was not discussed at all with mm-hmm. anybody at all. Zero. No.
Yes.
And as far as I knew, there were no other people in my high school that mm-hmm. were gay. I've since found out, you know, since coming out and being out and mm-hmm. talking to people that I went to high school with, that there were a lot of gay people in high school.
Right.
But we didn't know each other. We weren't connected. I didn't know them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very lonely, scary time.
Right. Then when you sort of flash forward a little bit, when you decided to become a banker, because you have a very interesting past with being your musician, your degrees in music, and
right.
then you become a corporate banker, and how did that whole process work?
Accident.
Yeah.
My father, again, was a musician, mm-hmm. so I started studying music really intensely when I was 10, and went to school for music every Saturday, all day Saturday, at the Cleveland Institute of Music. And then in high school, I would go to summer camps and study music the whole summer. So by the time I was graduating from high school, I was on a music path and went to the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music and majored in music, and then went to Yale and majored in music. But one of the reasons I went to Yale was I knew I didn't want to be a musician. I was accepted at Yale and Juilliard, and I didn't want to go to Juilliard. Juilliard's a music school,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't want to go to Juilliard because I knew I wasn't going to stay in music. And it wasn't because I didn't like music. It was because I didn't like the music business,
mm-hmm.
and I knew that. So I thought I'd get a wider education if I went to Yale and got my master's there. So I went there and really spent the 2 years studying music and pursuing my music career, but at the same time looking around. And I met a lot of people in a lot of different fields. And what I found in music was I couldn't find anybody that was a professional musician that was happy.
Yeah.
No one liked it. And my career path was to become a classical musician in a major symphony orchestra. That's what I was trying to be. I didn't know anybody doing that that liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, what am I doing? This isn't the right thing. So I basically interviewed a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And the people that I found that seemed to enjoy their work the most were bankers.
Really?
And also, the thing that they said was interesting about their careers was that they got to talk to a lot of different people in a lot of different industries.
Okay.
Because they were dealing with financing a lot of industries. So I thought, that sounds fun. Maybe I'll try that for a while. So I found a bank in Philadelphia where the personnel manager was nuts. She was absolutely certifiable, delightful, and taking piano lessons. And when she found out I was a musician, that's mainly what she wanted to talk about. The entire interview was about her piano lessons. And what was happening at the bank, this was in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, what was happening in the banking industry as a whole is banking was starting to open up and become more unregulated.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were finding was that what they needed were MBAs, people who were older, to come into commercial lending, but there were too many other opportunities for MBAs besides commercial banking, which was still regulated to the point where it wasn't paying very well.
Okay.
And they found that people with BAs were too young. So they wanted to try something different and hire some people who had different backgrounds. So I just kind of happened on that.
Okay.
And was hired into a bank in Philadelphia, and I ended up staying there 9 years. They financed my MBA. I worked my way up to become a corporate lender, VP in the commercial lending area. Loved it. And really had a, it was like Monopoly. It was like really fascinating on a intellectual basis, very challenging. The people I worked with were really smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very fond of them, and they were really good to me. And then the last couple of years I was in Philadelphia, I became a healthcare specialist, and my portfolio was hospitals, doctors' practices, medical office building projects, and it was a very complex kind of financing because it involved the government and city and these large institutions, and it was really interesting to do that kind of work, and I kind of created a little name for myself, if you will, a little bit. In Philadelphia as a healthcare lender. My partner at the time was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was she got a job at Henry Ford.
Oh, okay, so that's how you ended up in Detroit then.
Right, so okay. We moved here. And I moved here and began working here for Manufacturers Bank, which is now Comerica Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real shock. It was a real culture shock moving here. From the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
It was like stepping back 15 years in terms of women in the workplace. LGBT was still not, I mean, I wasn't out at work at all.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't out in Philadelphia. I didn't know any gay people in Philadelphia in the workplace. I certainly didn't know any here, and it was definitely not okay to be gay at work. And so I went into general lending. Am I talking too much?
No, perfect.
Okay. I went into general lending in the U.S. Banking Division and at Manufacturers Bank. And I was there for about a year, and then management decided they wanted to establish a healthcare group.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew about my background. They came to me and they said, would you like to lead this group? We'll have some other lenders and we'll reach out and build. Because healthcare lending is very, especially then, was very specific.
Okay.
It wasn't something that translated well to other kinds of. It was nonprofit finance. It was nonprofit accounting. You're dealing with government finance of the healthcare industry and insurance. And all. So it was a different thing. It wasn't something you could just pick up in a day. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. Finally, I get to do something like I knew what I was doing, which is rare for me to do something that I know what I'm doing. And so anyway, months went on when we were talking about doing this, and at that time, also what was going on in my personal life was my parents became very sick, both of them became really sick, and I was spending a lot of time going back and forth to Cleveland, and dealing with them, and and worrying about them and worrying about what was going to happen to them and mm-hmm. what was the next step. And then we had a meeting. This had been going on at the bank for a little while, and we had a meeting with like the president of the bank and some of the other the hoop-de-hoops at the bank and my boss, my immediate boss, to talk about whether or not we were going to pursue this healthcare thing. And my boss said at one point in this meeting, he said, this is going to be great because the only other bank that has a healthcare group is NBD, and the guy who runs it's a faggot. No one wants to deal with him. And the you know, the universe is open to us. And my heart just stopped. Mm-hmm. I realized at that point I had no future at the bank. As soon as they figured out I was a lesbian, I was out. And why would I want to do that to a fellow gay person anyway?
Right.
So that combined with what was going on with my parents, I resigned 3 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
And just left the banking industry, supposedly for 2 years. That was in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been starting to get involved at that point with some people who were trying to start up a new gay and lesbian mm-hmm. hotline.
Okay.
And I was volunteering on the hotline at that point. And for a variety of reasons, the funding for the hotline was kind of shaky.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to end. And there was a lot of discourse in the organization that was hosting the hotline. It was actually a gay political group called Michigan Organization for Human Rights. And there was a discord at the board levels whether or not they should be doing this and whether it makes sense for them.
Mm-hmm.
They were a political organization. Should they be doing a hotline, which is social service, blah, blah, blah. So they decided to close the hotline. And there were about, I don't know, maybe a dozen of us who were the regular volunteers on the hotline. And what had just impaled my soul listening on the hotline was that most of the people that were calling in had no one else in their life to talk to. And here they are calling a complete stranger. And for a lot of the people that were calling, it was the first time they actually said, I think I'm gay.
Mm-hmm.
And the pain and the loneliness and the isolation, I could relate to it, but it also broke my heart. And it was true for this group of people that were the hotline volunteers. We were like, oh my God, we're going to stop this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we created affirmations.
Okay, so this is sort of how, in a way, that you came to activism, in a sense. Okay.
Yeah. I'd been involved in nonprofits before, but not... I had been on the board of Women Organized Against Rape in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And had done board-level nonprofit work.
Mm-hmm.
And also had done, as a musician, I was involved in a lot of arts nonprofits. So I'd had exposure to the nonprofit world. But this was the first time that I'd actually done direct service,
mm-hmm.
was doing this hotline work.
Okay.
And it blew me away. It did. It just blew me away. And so what we did was this group of people got together and we created affirmations. And we kept the hotline going.
Mm-hmm.
First in a house in Detroit that was owned by two of our board members, Sue Pittman and Chris Puckett. They had a kind of a side business where they would buy houses in Detroit and fix them up and rent them. It was kind of a little real estate thing they had going.
Now, is this in 1989 that you started this?
Yes.
Okay.
It was like the end of, it was 89. No, 79. 79, 80.
Oh, 79. Okay.
Oh, wait a minute. No, you're right. 89. Right. That's right.
Okay.
Right. I'm sorry. Wrong.
No,
okay.
No, that's fine.
89, 90. In there. Right. And so we started doing it at this house in Detroit. We were there for about 6 months, and then we rented a suite in a little office building up in Ferndale, moved it up in Ferndale, and started there.
Okay.
And what happened to Sue and Chris, they were on the board. They were original board members of Affirmations. They were part of the 12.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a couple. And they lived in Trenton, Downriver somewhere. And they got into a fight with their neighbor over their fence. And it escalated, and they one day went out and started to build this fence. And the guy hated living next to lesbians and was always yelling at him about it and stuff. So he walked out with a shotgun and killed him.
Oh, my God.
Right in the front yard, right in front of the neighbors and everything. Blew them away.
Oh, my goodness. Was he ever prosecuted for that?
He was prosecuted when he died in jail. It was horrible, and it was devastating to everybody around them, mm-hmm. certainly to the 12 of us, and to their families. It also taught me, because at that point I was the executive director of the community center.
Okay.
Because I basically morphed into being a de facto leader of this group of 12, and then became the president and then the executive director.
Right, and that's in 1993, correct?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I think I ran it as the president for 3 years and mm-hmm. as executive director for 3 years.
Okay.
I think that's about right. I think. It's close.
Gotcha.
Actually, I tried to hire someone else to be the executive director, and they turned it down, so I became the director. What it taught me when Sue and Chris were murdered was that it terrified the gay community that happened. Mm-hmm. Even though they became symbols of the violence against gay and lesbian people.
Mm-hmm.
And being close to them as friends and coworkers, I had a different perspective on what happened to them than what it meant to the community at large. And it was the first, it was a real lesson to me about being a leader and how to frame things and how to, and I realized that what it meant was it undermined the community's feeling of safety.
Mm-hmm.
That they had none. And they felt vulnerable and they felt frightened and they felt frightened for themselves, and it was causing people to run away and to go back into the closet and to feel disempowered. And so what we as a group did was responded to that by being very public about our reaction to the murders.
Mm-hmm.
And it taught me a lot about using the public sphere to communicate a message of outrage and how important that would be, not only within the political environment and with the effort to make change happen, but also what that meant as a leader speaking for people who were too frightened to speak for themselves.
Right. Now, do you remember how that was then portrayed through the media at the time, the murders, and then subsequently what you did after that to sort of spread the awareness?
The media actually was pretty good about it, because it was so blatant.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like, were they killed because they were gay? It was like, they were murdered because they were lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
They were murdered by their neighbor because he hated living next to lesbians, and he didn't like it, so he did what he thought he could do about it, which was blow them away.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so violent and so atrocious.
Yeah.
The media didn't really back away from framing it as a hate crime.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there were no hate crime legislation then, so there was nothing, there was no political sphere to frame it in other than this is horrible and this happens to gay people all the time and this is not the first time, it's not the last time, this happens to gay people. And it's important for the community center as an institution to be aware of that and to be the spokesperson for the community when this happens.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a learning experience for me.
Oh, definitely.
In terms of how to be a community leader and when to step out. And people felt like us stepping out was very brave, to be out there as gay and lesbian people right after a shooting. I didn't really feel like it really took that much courage, because I didn't really feel like someone was going to shoot me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really fear that directly. But I was struck by how people reacted to that. I thought, oh, wow. This is hitting a nerve that's I don't have, but I see it happening in the people that are looking to me for leadership.
Mm-hmm. So then what was the community response with affirmations in general even before this time and then at this time, also when you were being more publicly visible?
Well, Affirmations was very much a fledgling organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were really, you know, struggling to get up on our feet, you know, money, you know, all that stuff. It definitely increased the visibility for Affirmations. Mm-hmm. We did several vigils, and we did some events to try and raise money for Chris's orphan, mm-hmm. who was like 13 at the time. That's a whole other tragedy that is heartbreaking in and of itself, is what happened to him.
Yeah.
He's in jail.
Okay.
His grandfather, who was Chris's father, took him in, but did not want him to know that his parents were gay and wouldn't let him have any contact with the gay community. He got involved with gangs, involved in a shooting that left a little girl dead, and has a life sentence now.
Oh my gosh, that's just...
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's just like cascading
right.
generations of horror.
Right. Well, and it's so hard too, because Affirmations would have been a place that would have been a safe space for him after all of that. That it's just...
Yeah. And the art gallery at Affirmations is named after Sue and Chris. He didn't even know that.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
Until after he'd already been convicted and was put in jail. And he reached out to me from jail and started to learn about his mother's legacy. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know any of it.
Yeah.
So.
Coming back to Affirmations in general, how do you feel that the center then has changed from the very beginning of it towards more modern times now?
Wow. It's
a big question.
Yeah, it is. It's a big question. It's gone through lots of up and downs in the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the highlights was when Leslie Thompson came in as the executive director in like 95, I want to say, mm-hmm. along in that range, maybe a little later. I don't know, I have the timeline probably quite right. But her vision was to lead the organization to eventually the capital campaign that's resulted in that fabulous building that's now in Ferndale. Mm-hmm. And she was executive director, I want to say, about 8 years. 6 to 8 years, something like that, and really led that campaign and led a capital campaign kicking and screaming forward mm-hmm. to raise $5 million to build the building. And it's really remarkable. And it's become a home for the gay community.
Yeah.
And when stuff happens, like when Pulse happened, hundreds of people just instinctively went to Affirmations. And you know, what's happening now with the election is people are going to Affirmations because, you know, after the election of Donald Trump, mm-hmm. people went to Affirmations because they were so upset and they wanted to go home to find out what their people were saying. Mm-hmm. And it's been a place for people to vent their fear and their nervousness about what was going to happen and what is happening. And mm-hmm. it's also a place where people have been able to organize and do something
right.
in response to the backlash. Mm-hmm.
Now, moving in a little bit of a different direction, you and your partner or wife at the partner in 1994, you purchased Between the Lines.
Yeah.
And the subsequent, your media source group.
Right.
I'm using the wrong name, but...
No, you're close.
Yes. So when did you decide to purchase that? Why did you decide to do that? Was that a part of outreach connected with Affirmations or...?
Well, okay. Sort of. Wasn't anywhere near that thought out. Susan and I were both on the board of the National Gay Lesbian Task Force.
Okay.
In Washington, D.C. That's how we met. Mm-hmm. She was from New York. She had owned a printing company there and had done that for 13 years. It was a lesbian, an out lesbian owned and identified lesbian printing company. Mm-hmm. Great business model, I'll tell you. And she was on the front lines of the New York City gay rights movement. She was grand marshal of the parade one year. She helped organize New York Pride. She published the New York City Pride Guide through her printing company. Was very involved in the early days of the AIDS crisis. And was a activist in New York. We met on the board. My relationship with my doctor had fallen apart, and we got together, and she moved out here to be with me. And she sold her company in New York, and she was kind of casting around for her next move. And I also had resigned from Affirmations. I gave them like a 4-month notice. So I was in that 4-month period where I was still working at Affirmations, but I was cycling out. And one of the things that was so frustrating as an organizer in the early 90s was it was very difficult to communicate with the community. I really wish there'd been a newspaper. There had been a couple of stutter starts. Most of them didn't work. This is before the internet, before social media. I mean, really the only way to communicate with our members was to call them. There's only so many phone calls you can make in a day. So it was really hard to frame issues and to speak about things except through the mainstream media, which then always translated it into straight speak about gay people. It was never about gay people talking about gay people. So I really wanted a paper to work. I didn't think I was going to do it. But Susan moved out here, and Between Lines had started. There were a couple of students from U of M who had started it up. And it was a monthly. It was very radical, actually. They were radical fairies that started it. So that the paper was outrageous. And it but I loved it. And I said, Susan, I said, you know, the people who are working on this paper are really having a hard time. And they really need some help, and they're great folks, love them to death. Why don't you go meet them and, you know, see if there's something there for you. You know, as just as one of the things you might want to do while you're here until you find your way. I figured she'd probably start another printing company. That's what I thought she'd do. Foolish me. Anyway, she went out to breakfast with the publisher at that time, a lovely woman named Shannon Rhodes. Came back from breakfast, and I said, so how'd your breakfast go? And she said, great, I bought the paper. And I said, you did? I thought you were buying breakfast. She said, no, I decided I bought the paper. Shannon's leaving town, and she was looking for a buyer, and so I bought it. I said, oh, great, okay. So we talked about it, and like I had already been coming to Wayne State. I thought I wanted to become a teacher.
Okay.
So I thought I'd, you know, get a teacher certificate and do that. And I said, I'll help, you know, for a while. I know a lot of people. I can help sell ads. You know, let me help you get it going. And so 25 years later, still doing it. And it's been quite a ride. It has been quite a ride. It certainly wasn't something that we sat down and said, let's start a newspaper in Michigan and this is what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
It's been a completely organic, accidental kind of thing. But we clearly come at it from an activist point of view. I mean, there are gay papers out there and across the country that are more from people have come to it who came from journalism backgrounds or business backgrounds exclusively and wanted to do a gay paper. Some of the gay papers are actually even owned by non-gay people and even holding companies that own many papers, including a gay paper. That's not where we're coming from. We're activists. We own it. We're progressive. We want equal rights for LGBT people and everybody else. And you know, we don't make Republicans happy with what we write about.
I could definitely see that, and I think that's wonderful. So then in general with Pride Source Media Group, I got it now.
Yeah.
And then your subsequent digital website too. How do you feel that that has sort of affected the LGBTQ plus community in the Detroit area and even broader?
Well, I think that we've been successful in our mission to have LGBT people tell LGBT stories. Mm-hmm. That's been our main goal. And to frame issues from our perspective. And that's been our goal. I think we've done it to some degree. We've certainly missed at certain other times, but it's not been perfect. It's not been a straight line of success. But we've certainly tried as hard as we can, mm-hmm, to employ LGBT people, to have them be the voice of LGBT people, to cover the community and what it's doing, to frame its issues, to talk about its struggles, to fight for the community when we can, and to be involved. Both Susan and I have remained involved in the community. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've often said about, because Susan and I, neither one of us are trained in journalism, but, you know, classically trained in journalism. Mm-hmm. You know, I have some education and I have a business degree and stuff like that. And Susan's got a lot of expertise in production. Mm-hmm. But we feel passionately about the issues. And we've looked to our staff who are trained journalists, mm-hmm, to help with the framing of that.
Right.
And sometimes they've had to, like, slap us down when we get out of line. But we've learned a lot about what it means to frame issues and to fight. And we've remained involved in organizations. Mm-hmm. Some publishers won't. Mm-hmm. You know, they think it's a conflict and say it's a conflict for us to be actually involved in organizations and helping with the community. We figure there's a difference between having a vested interest and a conflict of interest. We'd
right.
rather have a vested interest.
Mm-hmm. Now, how large of a staff do you have that works with all of these different mediums?
The most we've ever had was 16 staff.
Okay.
That's a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we have 7.
Okay.
And then we have freelancers.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the result of the recession, mm-hmm, which was devastating. And also the change in the way papers are created and the technological advances in newspaper publishing in general and the rise of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things have made it more difficult to finance and easier to do with fewer people.
Right.
And balancing that has been hard.
Yes.
And continues to be hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that you've written, just yourself, over 191 articles.
I have?
So, yes, you have. Do you have one that, like, sticks out to you? Something that really, I don't know, has stayed with you after all this time?
Wow.
Which is a lot to pick from.
I can't remember if I can remember any of them. I think that probably the political ones.
Mm-hmm.
Interviewing politicians and listening to them kind of wake up to what's happening to the gay community. I think I did this interview. I got to know Jennifer Granholm pretty well.
Okay.
Both before, during, and after her governorship.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time interviewing her right after she'd become governor, and she was appalled at the right wing in Lansing.
Mm-hmm.
She said, they're a bunch of Neanderthals. They want to turn us back, you know, they have no vision for civil rights. They want to take everything away from everybody. They're mean. And I'm looking at her and I'm going, yeah. And because the LGBT community had been a target of the right wing for years, and continues to be,
mm-hmm,
a target of radical right wing activists for a long time, and we'd heard all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And for her, it was the first time she'd been the target. And as a Catholic, and as governor, and as a woman, to hear the vitriol was new to her. And she said, "Have you ever heard, can you believe this?" And I said, well, governor, yes. As a matter of fact, I have. And she kind of like, her eyes opened up, and she mm-hmm. realized that this was new to her. It was kind of like when my awakening as an activist mm-hmm. and realizing the role of a leader, I saw that happen in her. Mm-hmm. And saw her realize that there was real danger to a lot of people that she had never seen before as a Harvard-trained attorney in Michigan.
Yeah.
And she was astounded. Mm-hmm. So that was a very moving experience for me. I don't know if she remembers it, but it was a very moving experience for me, and to write about that.
Right.
And to talk about educating the political environment. Mm-hmm. And that's been an ongoing thing that the paper and Susan and I have done as political activists, is to make the political realm understand what's at stake. Mm-hmm. And I think more now than ever, it's abundantly clear what's at stake.
Right.
And I'm gratified that I feel like there's a lot of leaders who get it. Mm-hmm. And 20 years ago, there weren't a lot of leaders who got it.
Right. Well, along those same lines, how do you feel that your work or your professional goals has changed since the 2016 election?
Since the 2016 election?
Mm-hmm.
What we've done since then is reached outside the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, even though we're under-resourced and we're under-organized, and sometimes it's like herding cats, getting the gay community to do anything in one direction, mm-hmm. most LGBT people who identify with the community understand that our civil rights don't exist in Michigan. We don't have any. Mm-hmm. That marriage is not a guarantee of anything. That you can get married on Saturday and fired on Monday for being gay, for getting married, and that happens, and that there's people out there who are fighting against us. One of the things that's happened politically in Michigan is that other communities are starting to accept the LGBT community as a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, when John Kerry ran for president, he would not embrace the LGBT community as part of his constituency for fear of alienating too many moderate Democrats who just weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
That's really not the case anymore. The Michigan Democratic Party in particular, and the National Democratic Party, has embraced the LGBT community as part of it. There's an LGBT caucus within the Michigan Democratic Party that's very active.
Mm-hmm.
The chair of that is one of the vice chairs of the party. And we're an integrated part now of the progressive movement.
Mm-hmm.
For the last, since 1996, we've created a voter guide every other year. And we've always talked about the other endorsements from mm-hmm. other progressive groups. This is the first time in 2018 where we're actually in a real partnership with the ACLU, the ACLU-CIO, the UAW, Planned Parenthood,
mm-hmm.
The environmental groups. And the voter guide that we've created is actually the voter guide that they're using and sending to their constituencies.
Mm-hmm.
And it says who's supporting progressive groups,
mm-hmm.
which candidates are supported by progressive groups, which aren't, which are supported by right-wing groups.
Right.
And that's information that's being disseminated across the state by not only us, which is what was happening when we first started,
mm-hmm.
but also by the UAW and Planned Parenthood and the Sierra Club and League of Conservation Voters
mm-hmm.
and NOW. They're using that information that we're creating as our and embracing us as a partner. So that's different. it's increased our, hopefully we'll find out Tuesday.
Yes.
It's increased, it's broken down some of the silos, because now the progressive community, women understand that the attack against the right to make decisions about your own body are very similar to the attack against gay people for the right to be able to be who they are.
Mm-hmm.
There's a connection there.
Right.
It's not the same thing, but we have the same enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to control us in the same way.
Right.
And African-American people, a lot of them, understand that when the right wing goes after gay people, that's often a canary in the mine for their next.
Right.
And so it's not always an easy partnership with a lot of these groups. It's not always, it's not kumbaya.
Mm-hmm.
It's work.
Right.
But it's good work, and we're getting there.
Now, do you feel that these partnerships are a direct result of Donald Trump coming to power and this sort of move towards right-wing, almost nationalism in a sense, in the United States? Or was this something that you felt would organically happen on its own either way?
It's been happening for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Fits and starts. Like any other movement, it's not linear.
Mm-hmm.
There's moments where things suddenly change. The election of Donald Trump, I think, scared the hell out of people.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've seen this. We've seen what happens when people embrace a demagogue.
Mm-hmm.
and want to give him unlimited power. It's never gone well. And we have the benefit of knowing history and can look back and say, watch out, we've seen this. But that's no guarantee that it's not going to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people are really frightened. And rightfully so, I think. You know, one of the things that Gillum says in Florida about DeSantis, his Republican challenger, is that he's not calling him a racist, but racists see him as a racist. That's why they're supporting him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what's in Donald Trump's heart. I really don't. I don't know if he has a heart. I think he's all about him. And I don't know if he would sell us out to the next greatest thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who really hate gay people think he will. So,
yeah.
And he's got Mike Pence right there next to him,
mm-hmm.
who would love to make us illegal again.
Mm-hmm. Now, sort of along those same lines, what do you think the next legislation should be to support the LGBTQ+ community? Is there anything in particular? Or right now, are we just combating anything that would harm what people have already won?
Mm-hmm. Well, on the federal level, the Equality Act
mm-hmm.
is a must. And what that would do would be extend full civil rights protections in the workplace, public accommodations,
mm-hmm.
To LGBT people nationally. That's been introduced many times. It's never really gotten anywhere. It would require a change in the House and the Senate. I hope, if it passed the House and the Senate, that Trump would sign it. I don't know. Barring that, at the local level in the state, our state civil rights, the Elliott-Larsen Civil Rights Act, does not include LGBT people. Which is why LGBT people in Michigan really have no rights and can be fired from work. I threaten my straight employees sometimes. I say, if you don't behave, I'm going to fire you because you're straight.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that. And I said, yes, I can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your sexual orientation is not protected in the civil rights. And they're like, oh, that's not fair. I said, really?
Exactly, right.
Well, it's always a fun conversation.
Oh, I'm sure. So sort of in general, thinking on your whole career to date, is there anything that I suppose that you're most proud of about your activism throughout the years?
Oh, God. I don't know if I really think about it like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more inclined to think about what I wish I'd done. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I think probably I feel really blessed to be gay. As a kid from a white kid from a small town in Ohio, I had every chance to grow up to be limited and narrow. And being gay has opened the world to me in ways that I never, I don't think, I certainly wouldn't have experienced had I been not gay. I met people and were challenged by people and taught by people and reached out and looked for mentors who were very different from me and had very different backgrounds from mine that really taught me a lot. And I've learned a lot. I have a lot to learn, but I've learned a lot. And I think that's been an amazing journey for me that I really embrace. I'm really glad I'm gay. I'm, you know, 40 years ago when I was a kid growing up, I would not have said I was glad. I was terrified I was gay. It was horrible. How could this be? But it's really been a gift. And so I feel like I've gotten more out of it than I've given.
So. Well, I think many other people would maybe say otherwise, but very humble. well, along that same lines, what would you say to future LGBTQ kids that are growing up and people that want to be active in the community and they want to be allies for the community? What would be some advice for those types of people?
Be fierce. Yeah. Don't be afraid. And it'll get better. It does. It does get better. I mean, when I look back at what it was like for me when I was in high school, with zero outlet, zero support, zero. And what young people have now, and to think about what they could create for the next group, it's really exciting. And I think that hang together, don't demonize the enemy, try to stay open. One of the things I say about when I was 16, the only thing I really miss about it is the last time I knew everything. And one of the things about getting older and the blessing of getting older is realizing what there is yet to learn. There's so much more. And I think that young people really have an opportunity to go places that are unimaginable right now. And go for it. Stay open to it. See what happens. And take care of each other.
And is there anything else that you would like to cover that we haven't touched on yet?
You know, I own a doggy daycare.
You do? Well, I know you have, what is it, 4 pets? Is that right?
Well, right now I just have 3. But
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, this is not part of, my sister started a doggy daycare in Plymouth 16 years ago.
Okay.
And, about six, seven years ago, Susan came to me. My sister started to get really sick. And Susan came to me one day and she said, "You do realize your sister's running her business into the ground." I said, "Yeah, I know." She said, "You do realize that if she goes bankrupt, she's going to end up living with us." And I love my sister. I could run a business, but I could not live with my sister. So we went to her and took over her business and kept it going so that she could be independent. And she died 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so now we own it. So my day's like a sitcom. Doggy daycare, gay paper. I never know what's going to happen.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, so well, it keeps me light.
Yes. Well, good. You might need that sometime.
I need it a lot. We had a canine costume contest on Saturday that was a blast.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. So.
Well, thank you very much.